And I'd like to welcome again Dr. Ray, who today is going to present a seminar on the biography of temple complexes. Anandpur Aihole. I always wonder how to pronounce that correctly. You know.
Oh, that's fine. You're doing all right.
And, Patadakal.
Yes.
I'm not So over to you.
Okay. Oh, thank you. My apologies, I'm not showing slides today because the last time it didn't work out very well. Also, this is the last talk in the series. So what I thought I would do is, A, I'm going to read, and B, I have divided my talk into three. In the first part, I will present a kind of summary of what I've done in the first three talks and sort of really pull in all the ends to take it forward. In the second part, I will talk about the temple as it emerged between 500 to 600 AD and about 1300 AD. And the last part, I'll try to show that looking at biographies of sacred complexes is a viable academic exercise, and that what we can learn from it, or how I perceive it. And I'm also looking forward to comments which will help me take this forward, because like I've said earlier, this is work in progress and I need to sort of move on. So let me just start by what I have already discussed, and a brief outline of when the temple first appears and what we have in the prehistoric record. The temple appears rather late in the archaeological record, around the 3rd-2nd centuries BC, though I suggested in the last lecture that there were continuities in terms of socio-ritual practices which we can trace back to the prehistoric period. These continuities, I argue, unique stones and their placement in habitation areas, and I'm referring to stones used as shivlings or also for Vishnu and so on and so forth. I'm not by any means suggesting that in the prehistoric period these were used for the same purpose, but I'm just saying that there are references, or there is evidence for unique shaped or differently shaped stones being revered. That's all. What they meant, I have no idea. In the prehistoric period. The second continuity that we see is the distinction between burial memorial space on the one hand and sacred and settlement space on the other. So certainly the distinction between burials and memorials and settlement emerges fairly early in the 6th-5th millennium BC and continues right through. Burial was not a mode of disposal of the dead. It was reserved for certain categories of people, and these categories varied over time, but certainly it was not something which was adopted by everybody. Third, of course, is the significance accorded to water in rituals and its association with sacred spaces, which later becomes a crucial feature of Hindu temple complexes. And finally, is the importance of communication through dramatic enactment or puppet shows or recitation. Though this is the most difficult to find, or most difficult to get data for in the archaeological record. And in the context of the Harappans, of course, the data or the evidence for this comes through masks or the use or the depictions on friezes or sculptures, because it's very hard to get any evidence for dramatic enactments and recitations. Now, one of the things that I've argued right through my presentations is that rather than a linear view of religious development, which means that, you have primitive religion, Buddhism, Hinduism, so on and so forth, Islam and Christianity, I have emphasized diversity, both in terms of religious structures, but also religious practices. So which really means that worship in Hindu temples coexisted with worship of trees or mountains and rivers, as well as the setting up of memorials to the dead and the reverence to these. And the second point I have also emphasized is that every holy spot was associated with more than one religion, be it Buddhism, Hinduism, or Jainism, as well as with local and regional cults. We do see changes in the way in which these spots relate to each other and in the way in which the larger sacred geography develops. There are various larger narratives which create this wider geography. The epics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata being the most important. But, you know, again, what gets connected with what at what point in time just varies through through history. So you have to sort of work out for each period the way in which these linkages are made. But certainly the earliest linkages that I talked about were the 4th, 3rd century BC linkages with the establishment of Mauryan rule in Indian history. This unity, this cultural unity, has often been attributed to political control, but I would suggest that the focus should be on communities who provided interlinkages, such as religious clergy, trading groups, scribes, storytellers, and performers, rather than the political elite or the rulers, as has often been the case. Now, the period, if we move on from there, the period between 2nd, 1st centuries BC and 4th century AD was a period of creativity and experimentation as far as religious architecture was concerned. And also this is the time when the superstructure evolved and the shrines take the shape that we know them, the Hindu shrine take the shapes that we know them today. Royal patronage of temples has often been written about, but it is seldom appreciated that inscriptions recording royal patrons date generally to a much later period, that is to nearly about 400 to 500 years after the earliest temples have appeared. So obviously these are appropriating the temple for the requirements of the political elite rather than the other way around. We also discussed in great detail the evidence from Nagarjunakonda, from the valley in Nagarjunakonda, where we have evidence for settlement from the Neolithic period in the 3rd millennium BC to the 16th century. And again, this is a region where we have, which provides evidence for Buddhist and Jain shrines, as well as for Iron Age megalithic burial sites. There was an increase in the number of temples from the 4th, 5th century onwards. The building of temples was by no means confined to the Gupta kingdom or North India. Instead, it extended over large areas of the subcontinent, from Gujarat in the west to Bengal in the east and to Karnataka and Tamil Nadu in South India, though we already have regional variations at this early period. The walls of the temples now provide space for the depiction of narratives and themes from the epics. The Ramayana and the Mahabharata share space with stories from the Panchatantra and those from the Purans. The most comprehensive depiction, of course, is in the temples of North Karnataka, Aihole, Badami, Mahakuta, and Pattadakal, which date from 500 to 750 AD. Though in the case of each of these temples, the placement of the panels is very different, so there's no uniformity that we are looking at. Now, one of the things that we discussed when we talked about the Ramayana panels is that the epics have generally been attributed a role of legitimization of political authority. But if one looks at the scenes that are depicted, the scenes that are chosen for their dramatic aspect rather than being necessarily associated with kingship or with the city of Ayodhya. So which means that the popularity, in terms of popularity, the scenes that find representation are the, you know, the exile of Ram, the abduction of Sita, and the battle with Ravan. Now, equally interesting is the fact that many of these scenes, already in the 6th, 7th centuries AD, have labels which identify them. And these labels, it has been suggested, you know, at one level are just identification labels. I think when one views them in the larger context of the way they are represented, I think they are mnemonic devices and indicate a more complex process that links the written word to the cultural transmission of texts. So which means that these, until recently in the Indian tradition, to read meant to read aloud. And writing was a mnemonic device for materials to be rendered oral again. The epic story in the written tradition of the Ramayana allowed endless variations when sung, danced, or sculpted. Thus, the temple, as the locale for recitation of sacred texts and of performance and festivities on special occasions, is unmistakable. So the point that I've been trying to argue is the fact is that the temple is firmly placed in the social milieu of the community. It relates to several levels of community life, and it should really be discussed and studied in terms of the people that came to worship or the people that related to it, rather in terms of legitimization of the political elite or largely in terms of art and architecture. So the question then arises, why has it not been studied in this way? And, you know, why do we need to make this shift? And this is what brings me to another aspect of this series of lectures, which is the historiography of religion as it developed in colonial and post-colonial India. This historiography includes writings on the history and religions of India, which identified religion with theology rather than cultural practices. It also adopted the monotheistic exclusivism of the Christian meaning of religion. This orientation emphasized theistic belief, exclusivity, and a fundamental dualism between the human world and the transcendent world of the divine in which one binds oneself. With a shift towards doctrine as constitutive of the essence of religion, the emphasis shifted on to the correct interpretation of texts, what is referred to as the textualization of Indian religion. And secondly, there was a tendency to define Indian religion based upon contemporary Western understanding of a normative paradigm of the Judeo-Christian traditions. A second process that marked colonial intervention in India was the introduction of academic disciplines turned scientific, whether these be archaeology, art history, or museology. And these disciplines are sort of really seen as creating new forms of knowledge. It is also a fact that many of these branches of learning have continued to dominate the study of the past in post-independence India, without adequate discussion of the concepts, agendas, and the processes or reasoning adopted by early practitioners of these subjects. Here it's important to realize that Alexander Cunningham is viewed as the father of Indian archaeology, whereas James Ferguson is seen as the one who introduced art history, but that in both cases there are several stereotypes that were created, and we are still with these stereotypes. There were others as well, scholars such as Rajendra Lal Mitra, who attempted a more holistic understanding of early Indian architecture, or Anand Kumaraswamy, who emphasized the inner meaning of architectural form and argued that a religious structure was not merely a place of worship, but a reflection of the cosmos. At another level, colonial legislation in the 19th and 20th century created new categories, such as archaeological heritage, and a distinction was sort of made between monuments and places of worship. Monuments were signifiers of the ancient cultural heritage and needed protection of the state, while state control with relation to places of worship was kind of ambiguous, and, you know, there was a, it was not very clear which way the state wanted to legislate. Nevertheless, this legislation altered the character of religious sites in the subcontinent from cultural pluralism to a monotheistic religious identity. Now, these colonial interventions corresponded with a fundamental conceptual shift among Indians who were exposed to English language and culture, which crystallized religious communities with sharp boundaries and distinct histories. So the whole way in which the Indian elite or the Indian literate elite viewed themselves or viewed religious identities impacted not only the discourse on nationalism, but also academic disciplines. Now, moving on from here, I think one of the points that I'm trying to make is that we then need to seek the colonial legacy in more complex terms rather than just looking at it in terms of the Orientalist discourse or the nationalist writings. And it is also quite clear that the shrine or the temple was the most important aspect of the Asian landscape. And hence it is important to locate it in a social context and to unravel the multiple levels at which sacred sites interacted with a diverse range of communities and negotiated between these. Now let me move on to the second section of my talk, where I'd like to point out some of the major features of the temple as it developed between the 6th, 7th centuries AD and the 12th, 13th centuries AD. This is also a period in Indian history which has been termed as feudal. And it is said that what developed in this point, at this point, was a self-sufficient village economy, which was based on agrarian expansion, and that this economy lasted until 1000 AD when foreign trade revived under the Arabs. Now, this period, it is said, showed developments which was very different from those in an earlier period. Others have shifted the focus from the economy to state formation, other scholars, and have argued that several states emerged in this period. They required legitimization, and this is where the temple and the Brahmins come into the picture. Sheldon Pollock has suggested that Sanskrit, through the medium of the Kavya, came to define a global cultural formation or cosmopolis from the 4th to the 13th centuries. This cosmopolis, he argues, transcended political boundaries and religious affiliations, thereby uniting intellectuals and their masters in a common aesthetic culture that extended across a wide geographical expanse. So, in effect, this is viewed not in terms of the temple or a religious culture, but largely as a court culture, and largely linked again to the political elite. And this is also, again, very clear in Daud Ali's work on courtly culture, where he looks at Sanskrit, the use of Sanskrit as lingua franca and associated aesthetic practices. But again, something which he does not talk about, and he says that in so many words in his book, is the whole issue of religious festivity or religious enactments. And I would argue that rather than looking at the period between 6th and 13th centuries AD as a period of secular courtly practices. This is also the period when several changes are taking place in the temples, and the temple becomes a much more focused territorial space as opposed to the court, which really doesn't have a place of its own, as it were. And I will state what this means. The political centers or the capitals that one is talking about, there is no correspondence between the political capitals and the location of temples. So there is a disjunction between political space and religious space. And this can be seen whether one looks at Gujarat, whether one looks at the Maitrakas, which came up in Gujarat, where the political capital was at Cambay, which is at the head of the Gulf of Cambay, whereas the temples are all along the coast. And this is again true of the North Karnataka, the Chalukyas, the temples that we have been talking about, where the elite are, most of the donations of the rulers were made from military camps or were made from pilgrimage spots rather than from a capital which can be identified and located in terms of the geography of the place. It is an evident that the temple occupied a central place in the life of the community, and it is also from the 6th century AD onwards that we get the earliest texts which talk about the construction of the temples. In addition to being shrines for the worship of the deity, temples continued to be built in memory of the deceased, and this is again a thread which sort of runs right through, where from burials to memorial stones and hero stones to temples built in memory of deceased family members or in memory of a king or a queen. The temple also emerged as the focus of attention of the literate community. The royal inscriptions were inscribed on the walls and stone pillars of the temples. It is poems to the deities were inscribed on its walls, while recitation and performance formed a crucial part of temple worship and ritual. And again, we have several instances of inscriptions which very clearly state that money was given or villages or donations were made, not just for the maintenance of the temple, but for feeding people in the at the temple. And more significantly, for music and dancing. And, you know, there are clear statements to this account. As in the previous period, the king protected the followers of Vaishnavism, Buddhism, and Jainism, and through his pious acts rendered the earth holy. This is from an inscription which talks about the king giving donations across the board. And certainly at the site of Aihole, in North Karnataka, we have both Hindu temples as well as temples affiliated to Jainism and Buddhism. Another major change in the 8th, 9th centuries was the fact that the temple emerged as community property. The temple was run either by the village assembly or by a person who was nominated by the village assembly, either a village headman or somebody else who could be appointed to run the affairs of the temple. But what is also quite interesting is that a 12th century inscription talks about a priest who purchased the right of management of the temple, and he actually paid money for it, so he could buy the right to run run the affairs of the temple. By the 10th, 11th centuries, religious shrines were located in close proximity to residential and commercial areas. This period is also known for the establishment of fortified settlements, particularly of markets being within these fortified settlements. And, you know, this is done largely for the way in which revenue was collected. But there are, the inscriptions again mention many of the temples being located within these fortified spaces, and that these locations shared with settlements of female attendants, oilmen, gardeners, potters, and washermen, and so on. So there was no exclusivity of temple space, as it were, if one is to go by these inscriptions. Another function of the temple was as a center for education. And between 750 and 1300, there are Ghatika sthans, which are mentioned as institutions of higher learning. And these institutions were supported by public bodies as well as by other grants. There are references to people traveling over long distances to go and study at these Ghatikas. And one of the Ghatikas that was very significant is that of Kanchipuram in South India, where a king went right across the Western Deccan or across Maharashtra to go and study. The Ghatikas were no doubt important for their learning, but gradually seemed to have become involved in the selection and coronation of kings. So the Ghatikas then play an important role in the way in which polity came to be defined and the rituals that were associated with it. This corresponds with the fact that the temple emerges as a major landholder after the king. And the income which comes from these landholdings and other donations are now being given on interest to clients. And there are stipulations in the inscriptions that this money is to be paid back with interest. And what is being given as loan is both in kind and in cash. So paddy can also be given or is being given to various people, either the village assembly or to villagers. And all of this has to be paid back to the temple, which makes it even wealthier. Now, given this sort of broad canvas in which the temple becomes a major landholder, also becomes very powerful in terms of the kind of authority that it has in terms of the the coronation of kings. I would argue that we need to look at the micro regions, and even within this broader canvas, we need to look at this North Karnataka complex that I had talked about earlier. Because one of the issues that I think is important, and one of the issues where the biography of temples then becomes very significant, is the survival of certain temples as opposed to others. Not just the survival, the fact that many of these are reinvented over time. They are reconstructed, or, there's Jirnodhar, which we talked about. Now, while others at the same time decayed or were abandoned, only to be rediscovered as monuments with the introduction of disciplines such as archaeology. So what then are the factors which are responsible for this longevity? Political patronage does not work, because what happens when one kingdom declines and another comes up? Does the temple disappear? Other kind of factors would be location. That would be one. But I think we need to move beyond, and also we need to see the way in which, a point that I made earlier, the Purans or other texts, they sort of lengthen the life of the temple. And this is where then, if we compare these three or four temple sites that we talked about, I think one can get quite interesting results. The first point, of course, is that the temple sites that I'm talking about are all within 150 kilometers of each other in North Karnataka. They are in a valley, about a 25-kilometer-long fertile valley of the river Malaprabha. The valley, hills close in on the valley on both ends. And that is quite significant, because if you want to get into the fertile valley, you have to get past one end of the temple complex, and the second end, you know, is the second temple complex. The other interesting point is that it was the way in which the hills close in on the valley, it was possible to form a dam and create a tank and store water. And hence, one of these temple complexes, mainly Badami, became very important in terms of its location at the end of this valley. But let me start with Alampur, which is located, which is the easternmost temple site located in Andhra. Alampur, we get reference to its sanctity as early as the 3rd century AD from an inscription which records donations made by an individual to the god of Alampur. Several temples were built between the 6th and the 8th centuries at the site. These temples in the 16th century came to be known as the Navabrahmas, so the nine temples of Brahma. But the earliest and the earliest record of this Navabrahma term is in a 1526 AD inscription, which is long after the temples were created. And there is no mention of these temples as Navabrahmas in an earlier period. Now, what explains this change in terminology is the fact that the Kalamukhas became a dominant sect in the region from the 9th century onwards and wielded enormous influence in the area, which, as a result of which, the area came to be known as Brahmeshwar Sthan. And this is what the Purans pick up, and this is what the Purans then mention and talk about the nine temples at Alampur as the Navabrahmas. Now, in contrast to Alampur, which was a complex, which, you know, where the temples are located in a cluster, Badami was a fortified settlement. And Badami is also the place where the earliest inscriptional records of the Chalukyas are found. Like I said, it is at one end of the valley between two rocky hills, and is also a site which at which we get references to hostilities between the Chalukyas and the Pallavas. And it changed hands between one and the other. And then you have, you know, one set of inscriptions following the, you know, the other set of rulers. But what is significant is at Badami is the tank, which comes up as a result of the damming of the water between the two hills. This tank provided not only the supply of water to the town, but it seems to me was an important factor for the continuity of settlement at the site. Temples were built all along the north side of the tank and the settlement at the site continues as late as the 13th, 14th centuries. There is a mosque at the site which was built right next to the rock-cut caves in about the 13th century. I mentioned that the site was fortified. There are references to conflict between Tipu Sultan and the British, and a British detachment under Thomas Munro finally took the fort of Badami in 1818. And at present, the town of Badami continues to be the major center from which one can see these temples in the Malaprabha Valley. So the major advantage of Badami was its tank, was the water. was also the fact that it was fortified. It was located along in an area, in a strategic location, which could be easily defended, and the fact that this led to its continuous occupation from the prehistoric period right into the present, as opposed to Alampur, you know, which we don't see very much of after the 16th century. The other site, which is not very far from Badami, which is contemporary to it, is only about 40 kilometers from Badami, is the site of Pattadakal, which we had talked about earlier. Since it is the site of the royal inscriptions, it is also the site where the queens set up temples to honor, or in honor of the victory of the kings, their husbands. So it is a site which is closely associated and linked to royalty, particularly to the Chalukyan victories over the Pallavas. And it is also a site which has the most beautiful temples, you know, if as compared to all the others. But again, we do not hear much of Pattadakal after the 9th century AD. And it is a site which we're not very clear when it falls into disuse, but we do not see continuous habitation at Pattadakal beyond the 9th century. But perhaps the most interesting of all is the site of Mahakuta, where again a tank was built, but there is a an underground water source at the site, as opposed to Badami, you know, which is at one end of the valley. The temples at Mahakuta were located near natural springs, and function today as places of great sanctity where regular festivals are held. So Mahakuta continues to be in worship. It is also mentioned in the Mahatmyas. There are stories relating to the destruction of the demon brothers Vatapi and Ilvala by the Saint Agastya. And this is a story which occurs in the Purans. The Skand Puran also mentions the site as the abode of Shakambhari. So Mahakuta very clearly enters the Purans, and also achieves sanctity through legends associated with it, and which are then written down in the Purans. Now, the final site that I need to mention is the site of Aihole, which is at the other end of the river Malaprabha. It has the largest number of temples, but there is no evidence of any royal inscription or any Mahatmya linking the site to the Purans. Unlike Alampur and Pattadakal, these temples do not form a cohesive complex, but are instead scattered in a 4 square kilometer area. So they are sort of individual temples, you know, widely scattered rather than being located in complexes. Aihole has a marked Jain presence, and the inscriptional record indicates patronage provided by merchants and guilds, the best known being the Ayavole Guild, whose scope of operations included both South and Southeast Asia. The temples at Aihole continued until the 12th century, and we know that several renovations and additions were made, and these need to be taken into account. The Durg temple, of course, was the most ornate, and, you know, there are several additions which are made, but after the 12th century, there is no evidence of any further construction at Aihole. So with this brief overview of the temple complexes along the Malaprabha, we come a full circle, as these were also some of the earliest temples to be discovered in the 19th and 20th centuries. So we have both ends of the scale in these four temple complexes. There are some like Mahakuta which continue right through. or Badami, whose importance arises largely because of its fortified position and the fact that it is very strategically located. On the other hand, we have temples like Pattadakal, which was largely a royal complex, but does not seem to have been sustained much beyond 200 years. To conclude, the attempt has been to locate temples and temple art within a social milieu to indicate the dynamism and vibrancy of religious architecture and to stress the interpenetration of the literate tradition as exemplified by inscriptions on temple walls, with the oral as indicated by recitation and performance within the temples. The emphasis has been on the diverse nature of the sacred landscape, with the Hindu temple coexisting with Buddhist and Jain shrines, Lajjagauri cult spots, memorial pillars, and in some cases, Iron Age burial structures. Finally, I argue that these temples were not merely individual specimens of religious devotion, but were instead linked within a larger sacred geography, and it is these interconnections that provided a sense of cultural identity and anchorage to the community. Perhaps it is then time to reinvest the study of the temple with its cultural and religious meanings. Thank you.
I'm not open for questions or comments or so.
I don't want to be the first. I was very interested in what, coming from a Catholic background, I'm very interested in what you said about the return of community.
Yeah.
Because this is now a very big thing with us. We are going to get away, or we hope to get away from too much priestliness and more into community. And I don't know if you've ever been to Sherborne. Sherborne Abbey was started in the 8th century by Benedictines.
Yes.
And it's a very, very beautiful... You must go if you ever get a chance, Sherborne Abbey. It has a very, very beautiful ceiling and so on. And it was really very, very beautiful. And, of course, Henry got down there, Henry VIII, and started smashing it up. And all the people from Sherborne came, including the town, the mayor,
yes,
nothing to do with the priest,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm,
said, we want this, this belongs to us, you can't do this, we're going to turn it into a parish church, mm-hmm, and a community centre. And it's survived. It's one of the only ones. You know, if you want to see something that survived his attentions, this is where you should go.
Thank you.
I mean, some of that was really very thought-provoking, I thought.
Mm.
You said at some point that what I'm interested in is a sort of the textualization of religion, in a sense.
Yes.
So you've got these traditions. You've shown how there's continuity of archaeology, as it were, right through into the temple and so on, and how texts only become important at a certain period. You actually mentioned a date. I can't remember what it was, about the 7th.
I said that, you know, they get linked to the Purans.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, around the 8th, 9th centuries, by which time they've already been in existence.
Yeah.
And that varies. The date varies with different temples.
Right.
And the Purans pick them up, you know, at certain points. And then, you know, historians have evidence when it's actually written down.
Right.
So when a certain inscription then says, now this is the Navabrahma.
Yeah.
So you have a date for it.
Right.
But, you know, the Purans have already talked about it.
Right.
And have given it a different kind of identity. That identity was never there in the beginning when it was built.
So you've got...
So you've got several sort of...
strands here. But what's coming out through your talk, I thought, was that the importance of the temple and the sculpture and the architecture, as it were, as being... prior to the text, in a sense.
Yes.
So the question I'd like to ask is, when you have sculptures and representations of stories and so on, in a sense you have to bring text to bear to them to make sense of them. Do you have, not text in the sense of written text, but do you think that you have narratives and text in an oral sense which must be prior to the buildings of the sculptures, in a sense.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. Written word is only transitory.
Hmm.
It's somebody taking down an oral in order to for it to reemerge orally.
Hmm.
Yes.
You have to have text to make sense of the sculpture.
No. No. See, one of the problems that arises, and I think this is a problem, you know, which occurs again and again, is that in most cases, when you look at the text to make sense of the sculpture, one is doing two things. One is looking at data which is much later, and, you know, looking backwards at something which was built earlier. Secondly, there's a certain homogeneity in the text. You know, the texts don't relate to a temple. They relate to maybe a region, maybe, you know, a sect, or maybe one way of thinking. So in which case then they're homogenizing something which is very different. I mean, even 50 kilometers apart, the temples are very different. Now, so that doesn't, you know, to my mind, is not a very good way of doing it. Now, what is the alternative? The alternative then is, and that's what I'm trying to make sense and haven't gone very far, but is if one looks at the sculptural program of each of these temples, you know, which is very different. One can sort of make the distinctions within the sculptural program. But the problem I then face is, how do I take this forward? You know, so what do I then end up as saying? There is Varaha avatar on one end and, you know, Vaman on the other, and there is, you know, images of Vishnu. So it was clearly a Vaishnav shrine. But how do I take this forward into the whole narrative? Just on the basis of the sculptural program, I can just make the distinctions between a cave temple or a structural temple. But where do the stories come in? Because they don't, you know, I don't have any evidence at that point in time. The evidence I have is much later. And I'm not sure I have a way out of this, but that's the problem.
So you can trace these continuities, but I'm wondering if we have to propose a text that we don't know its contents.
No.
That isn't going a bit excellential, is it?
I don't know. I mean, so.
But why do you need a text? Why do you need a text?
I was just saying, Mahakuteshwar, Mahakuta, has, which Simancha talked about, is a site where it. I don't know what it manifests now as, but I think it's a kind of Shaivite site. It's Mahakuteshwar, isn't it?
Yeah, but now I think it's all these sites have a sort of mixture of local cults well as, you know, the Sanskritic cults.
The point I was making is that Mahakuta has a very strong Lajagauri bias. That you don't find in any text,
yeah.
Perhaps I should rephrase.
Yes, okay.
Get rid of the word text and say narrative. Do you not need to bring narrative to bear on this material?
I mean, narratives are always built around practices, I guess. So maybe the Lajagauri sign focus is the... And if you go on backwards, there might be some... At some point, you might find the earliest focus of whatever that is. Maybe you go back to your aniconic things, or maybe a confluence of rivers, or something really, really basic and rudimentary. And then people have all these layers accrued on them at point.
But, you know, you can't find the textual equivalence, the Lajagauri. You know, remember last time I showed this image in a rock shelter where there was a shivling, and then there was this female image on the ground. Now, the earliest, this is a fertility cult, which, you know, one doesn't have any textual accounts of. The earliest evidence, I think, goes back to the first century AD, and we have a shrine for Lajagauri. So clearly it was not just rock shelters, but, you know, it was also a shrine and a temple. The extent is from the northwest, from
From Gandhara.
From Gandhara, right down into Karnataka. So, you know, so it's quite quite enormous. Now this continues from 1st century AD right up to... We have inscriptions in 4th century AD where the queen is making donations at Nagarjuna Kunda to this image, you know, of Lajjagauri. And then it goes on, and there are many variations, and I think it continues right today into the present, where most of these temples that I've talked about, you know, the supposed Chalukyan temples, have have the main shrine, which dates 6th, 7th century AD, have this shrine of Lajjagauri, have a new shrine made in the, you know, in the same way as the Chalukyan shrines, and then you have these fairs or large gatherings which take place about once a year, where people come from all over the villages, and you know, and they worship something which has nothing to do with the everything that's there. So
it's just a good place to be.
Yes, that's true.
Meet your friends.
But you know, but there are a whole lot of these narratives which the village women.
Yeah.
Or the village people talk about.
Which are independent
of whatever the texts say, the Puran say.
Fertility.
Yes.
Great thing, isn't it?
Yes. And have a different.
We all worship fertility.
That's true.
We always have. It's 2,000 years before all of what we're talking about.
Yes.
Something on that note, which one you might be interested about, Maa Koteshwara, is suddenly recalled that this the word Kottai in a lot of South Indian languages means have to do with shamelessness.
That's why it's
and this particular image is very shameless. And because it's a strange goddess. I don't know whether you know of. Did you show a slide last time?
Last time I showed a slide. I don't know if anybody remembers. Yes. It's in the. It's a woman depicted as giving birth
or having sex. So it's like basically with.
Without the head.
But I guess, you know, does this also have the Shiva Linga? Is it also together with this?
Yeah, sometimes. It's kind of male equivalent of this. This can be a female equivalent of the linga thing.
The shivlinga is not always. Sometimes.
But I'm thinking if it's being positioned here and she's here. I mean, it makes a lot of sense just if you have one of the two, but you know, having them together in that depiction and she's headless, I mean, it's kind of makes two, you know, different interactions possible on different levels. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're not actually having. And I'm thinking of things I've seen in like Mayan and Aztec, where they also have goddesses and women in similar poses, but the head is gone.
Oh, okay.
And there's just one I'm thinking of.
What period are you talking about?
This
would be late.
Well, this would be maybe about 11th century. I mean, I think there's probably similar things happening around the world, but But this one depiction, it's kind of like, you know, if you're comparing the Titans and in the Greek mythology, where she's it's a sister goddess that's like almost like Tiamat. She's destroyed, and they cut her head off, and her body is torn, and so they actually show her the body disjointed, and then the head is separate. But they also have sculptures of this goddess, her head only, and it's got lots of like seashells and water imagery and things. But yeah, I think it's probably very similar if you've got it, maybe goddess or portion of the deity's body even. But I have a good question. It's a very basic question. I'm just now starting to get more into looking at Indian temples and iconography and all these things. But my background mainly is Egyptian and Nubian temples and those kind of things. But I mean, I know you mentioned inscriptions having different kings and queens offering, or maybe local priesthoods offering. Do you actually have a lot of depictions of the kings and queens in the temples, or is it more a temple set aside for a deity and the deity's images?
There are depictions of donor couples, as they are termed, of donors, and you know, these, their sort of features vary. Now the point is, which is the hard part, how do you identify that, you know, these were portraits of these donors and not just any donors or any worshippers? Because there's nothing which says out there. You know, unlike many other, unlike even Southeast Asia, where you do have the king, the image of the image of the god in the form of the king. But, you know, that doesn't happen in Indian temples. So you have the donors,
not explicitly.
I mean, it's possible these donors were, you know, were made in as portraits, but there's no evidence that one can put this down to.
I'm just making a comparison in my mind, you know, thinking especially of Egyptian and Sudanese temples, all the way through, it's a worship of the god, but it's always in connection to the ruling king or queen.
So I would like to see the I think there's a disjunction between political and religious.
We have one temple that's in Sudan. I'm going to actually be visiting this next next field season, and it's often been compared to having Indian influence, but I think it's just a combination. It's just it's a lion god that has three heads. But they've drawn it. See, it has three bodies also, but they've tried to kind of smear that. But it often will show the king, queen, and maybe a crown prince, but they're offering to a deity, and the deity is also giving them power and life and those kind of things. And it seems so different than what you're talking about in India, that it's, you know, really it's a cult center for a deity.
But in that case, are those people distinctly identified with inscriptions or whatever?
Well, the thing is, in the later periods, which is really past Egyptian influence more, and they're having to deal with Rome, they do have their cartouche with the names given.
Okay.
And we also assume that means that these temples were made by this king or this queen.
Yeah.
And it may have been done by the son after their death. I mean, we really have no idea for sure of dating, and we try to say that it's just, you know, links with, you know, the reign of Augustus and his wars in the north, but we can't say that either. But it seems very interesting comparing what's happening in Italy, what's happening in maybe Arabia or happening in Eastern Africa. It seems so different. What these temples really mean?
No, in India there's a clear separation between between the king and the temple, and I think that's that is quite significant as compared to even Mesopotamia or Egypt or anywhere else.
May I ask if there's any staff or monks attached to these temples?
There are certainly references to priests who perform worship, and starting from I think the 7th, 8th centuries there are references to donations or gifts being made to the priests,
nothing like a residential part of it
like the Buddhist monastic sites. The mathas come up, you know, the mathas are the residential areas. But that need not necessarily. But that's scholars. That need not necessarily be the priest.
But they live in the complex?
Whether it's.
Kalamukkas, you mentioned, didn't you? The Kalamukkas.
The mathas, certainly, they live there, and, you know. There certainly is residential complexes attached to the temple.
Priests were also living there? Or is it imperative for the priest to live nearby to maintain his sort of ritual purity and stuff like that, that he has to go in and worship?
See, that's very hard to... I'm just trying to think of the evidence that, you know, that would sort of... which I could quote and say, yes, you know, I have this evidence, or this is the inscription which says that. Because all you have is the structures attached to the temple. And certainly the school and the mathas are important there, but who exactly lived in there? You know, I mean, there are certainly scholars or the people who teach, and there are certainly people who are learning, and there are people who are performing worship. But it's only, I think, 9th, 10th century South Indian temples where you do have references to various communities of worshippers living in the vicinity, bringing various things for the temple, you know, flowers and incense and so on and so forth. That I think there are large residential...
I was just thinking we are actually in Oxford. Oxford is a very large donation by a king in order to help his soul along. And
that's how it all is. I was just going to say a little word about that textualization thing. I suddenly remember about this, that Mahakoteshwara is coming back to my mind, because one study that was made by a Maharashtrian scholar. It's a book about Lajagauri, and it's written in Marathi, unfortunately so, because it's really a good study.
Who was it?
It's a guy called lives in Pune called Dere.
Okay.
And he has actually proven that some texts which actually mention Mahakoteshwara and the Sthala Mahatmya kind of things have seen this image. They can't make any sense of it.
So they made up a story.
And they made up a story, and then it got absorbed.
That's a good idea, yeah.
I mean, then it goes on a completely different track. Because it's a kind of strange image that they can't really figure out, because it doesn't fit into any known, at least when they were doing
this
pilgrimage.
There's none of this that just came down from heaven. Hinduism doesn't go in for that sort of thing. I mean, you don't have Moses getting the tablets and all this sort of thing.
Not really.
It could be an easier answer. It
just dropped.
Yeah.
It was always there.
Okay, the fall was a bit too fast, so she couldn't get her legs straightened.
Well, why do you need text? We need to...
I was thinking that with that example, they made up the story to make sense of the image. It's a good example of what I mean. You have to make sense of the thing. And so they text... If you extend the notion of text into the notion of narrative, then you make sense of it through narrative. So I suspect that originally there was some narrative that accompanied the image, which has been lost.
Yeah.
And it gets reconstructed again in some... I think that we're deeply narrative creatures, human beings, and we need to make sense of life.
But then one could make sort of different. Each.
The thing is too, you can't say there wasn't always a text. I mean, I know you can't always say there was, because it may have been an imagery that was very well understood to them, or certain.
Or different narratives. You sort of talk about.
Yeah.
I've got a lovely Bedouin thing. Where the children to read on a piece of wood, Bedouin, and it's got lots and lots of squiggles, and the professor appears to read. it's just squiggles.
But he knows it off by heart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't go.
Well, that's one more point. I mean, if you know already know something, many texts well, and then you have reflections of something and coming and say, this might be it, that even happens now, isn't it? So people see one thing and they say that, this sounds something like and the woman holding the fish, that must be Vasudhara or something of that sort. That kind of association quite quick, quick fix thing. But
then you don't have a fixed narrative. In which case, there is no one narrative.
So we're way off the Muslims.
Yes, we have any number of narratives, and
I just remember there was talking about Moses. There was a Vasugupta who had a dream about the Shiva Sutras being on top of this mountain, Mahadeva Mountain in Kashmir, and he climbs up the mountain, and there they are, inscribed on a stone.
Where was this? Sorry,
Kashmir.
What's this?
Oh, they are on the stone.
Okay.
Vasugupta, the Shiva Sutras. But you go up there. There's the weather's washed them away now. The claim is in his text. He says, "I had a dream. Shiva appeared to me and said these sutras are inscribed on a stone at the top of this mountain." He climbs up the mountain and finds the Shiva Sutras there.
And then he sort of writes them down.
That's it. That's another piece of. I was saying this is again a kind of reflection of how these people had their own sense of archaeology. This is their, their own. We talked about in the first lecture when somebody asked a question about, what was it? I forgot.
If archaeology is a Western discipline, and it was superimposed or it was brought in the colonial period, then why should one follow that and not some other, traditional notions of the past?
Or did they have
the traditional notions of the past?
Yeah.
So this is Vasugupta finding.
Yes, Vasugupta finding inscriptions.
But this dream sequence is in many places. The Melkote, the main icon, was found because Ramanuja had a dream, then he went, and then he found this. And this image, this dream and image occurs many times.
Quite a lot, right? I mean, it's almost... almost all the temples, medieval temples in Maharashtra, where there are Swayambhu kind of, you know, images,
yes.
There's a story that, you know, someone dreamt and then he went and dug up and then they found something.
Right.
I think it's the other way. I mean, like, they go to do something and they dig up and they say, ah, this is a temple. Let me have a dream. Yeah. So...
No, but also the point, also I think the point there is that in many cases, you know, there is an earlier temple,
yeah,
which is then renovated,
sure,
at some point. Mm. But then when it is renovated, you know, it doesn't become a new temple. So it sort of goes back to an earlier position when, you know, this was a very ancient temple and this image was already there, but had been moved, and, you know, so it's sort of giving legitimacy or
or
a tradition.
Really,
yeah.
Or something
like that. We have well at in Kingsland, you know, Walsingham.
Yes.
That's 1050, so it's before the Norman conquest.
Okay.
And it's a lovely well, and this was a dream, Richenda, some lady who said that this well was sacred. And so it was sacred before the Norman conquest. And then the Normans come along and they say, oh, this would be a good place for a shrine. Let's have a church here. We'll turn it this way. And then it went out into... I don't think people made a fuss of it for a long time, for 500 years. Now it's thriving again.
Yeah. All these Christian saints coming up and appropriating Celtic sites in the same manner.
Yeah.
Because they have revelations and things like that. Yeah.
Yes, and it's all, oh, you must go to the well. Yes, go down the well. You get a little cup and have
right,
a bit of water. Why not?
Well, I think we should hold up, really, partly because I've got a class.
Do carry on.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Ray, for the third and final talk that you've given us.
Thank
you. I found the whole series really fascinating.
It's
really interesting, and look forward to reading them in due course when you publish them.
Yes, except that I still need to find text.
No.
Do you have any program of publishing Shiv Dasani's kind of booklets and things like that?
I don't think
at the moment, but we have them recorded.
Okay.
But we don't have a...
So you have a transcript kind of thing, but
it'll
not...
It will be on the net, I think, no?
Is it?
I need to transcribe them. That would be such an ordeal to actually, you know...
Yeah, it would be a good idea if we can, you know, all the four or five Shiv Dasani lectures can be brought out as a little pamphlet.
It would be
excellent
idea.
So,
and usually, though, the people who are doing them would want to publish them
as a book
or something.
Yeah. Yes,
but then I think it would be if it can be done through the center, it will be something, you know.
We've got a Hindu studies series.
Yeah, you can have an anchor for this, and I mean, let the people go on doing whatever. You can always say that these are work in progress in any case. And
well, we could do short books,
yeah,
little books, or something. Yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah. So anyway, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. That was an honor.